Members, I'm going to call the State Government Finance meeting to order. Members, in your packet are the minutes from April 15th. And Representative Pugh, you want to move the minutes?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Pugh moves the minutes for April 15th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes for April 15th are adopted. Representative Driscoll, I'm going to move Senate file. We need to move. Are we moving that? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So we're going to move Senate file 1398, and then members, just to get the bill in the order that we wish to have it, we're going to amend the House language from House file 1508 into the bill that will be substituted in. All those in favor with that, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Driscoll, with that, if you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. The bill that we have before us is the annual omnibus pensions bill. And Madam Chair, if you'd like, I could do a kind of a brief overview of the major sections. And I do have a couple of amendments this evening that we would like to consider and take up, if that's the will of the Chair.
And Representative Driscoll, do you wish to walk through it, or would you like to have staff go through it? What would you prefer?
You know, Madam Chair, if staff would like to go through it, then I can supplement or answer questions that members have, however you would like to proceed this evening.
Okay. Ms. Roberts or Mr. Shepherd, or which would you prefer? Maybe we'll have she was going to come through. Why don't you get us started, Representative Driscoll?
Okay, I'd be happy to do that, Madam Chair. There are 14 articles that are in the bill. I do not plan to go through every article and every item in every article. I want to just maybe condense it down to four major points that the bill addresses. The first area, there was an assumption that was changed a few years ago in the interest rate that relates to the rate of return that the state of Minnesota would be targeting on our pension plans at 8.5%. In state law right now, that number is 8% for a few more years, and it was the discussion and advice of the Pension Commission, as well as those providing data and resources to the Pension Commission, that we look at making that rate of return 8% on a go-forward basis instead of 8.5%. And that applies to all pensions with the exception of the TRA, the Teacher Retirement Association, and there are some extenuating circumstances because they're going to be undergoing some review and evaluation of the overall pension and didn't want to make that change until they had the other information to be able to be moving forward on that. Members who have been around the legislature for a few years also know that there are oftentimes constituents that will come to members and talk to them about some oversights, or local units of government may come and say there were some errors in tracking and reporting for various employees within public employ. And so the Pension Commission needs to review those situations and make recommendations in the pensions bill as to whether or not that was a bona fide error, if it was, to endeavor to correct that, or if it was something that the Pension Commission cannot deal with because it falls outside of the purview or the principles and practices of the Pension Commission. So there are a few articles that deal with that. Another area that we'll look at in the pension bill this year is we've codified across all major pensions here in the state of Minnesota a funding level of 80% and 90%, and that has to do with when you will receive cost of living allocations as pensionees. And we also have codified that on the backside with all pensions that should the rate of return fall below, or should the percentage of funding fall below 90% or 80%, that there would be, if you will, some blink offs on those cost of living allocations. And these are not coming as, I should say they are coming as recommendations from the various pensions and the pension boards, that we would proceed accordingly on that. There's also some other stabilizer language in here that deals with various pensions to, again, keep them solvent as time moves on. And there's some information in here that does some corrections and provides some more updated data for local volunteer relief fire departments and dealing with some mortality tables as to when those individuals may be eligible for benefits and how those would be paid out. And then finally, the last major area within the pension bill is that of the MRF merger, the Minneapolis Retirement Fund, which was merged into the PERA fund in two ways. One in 2009-2010 timeframe, the MRF fund was insolvent and it was put under the administration of PERA, the Public Employee Retirement Association, and they were managing those funds. And at that time, the state of Minnesota and the city of Minneapolis were putting together contributions to help stabilize what was very close to a bankrupt fund. This year, in 2014, that fund was at 80% of full funding, which was the target that was set in state statute, and that would then require or allow for a full merger of the MRF fund into the PERA fund. As a part of that, we also saw that there was an actuarial evaluation that came back that adjusted the amount of money that was necessary to continue funding that pension and those benefits. And as a result of that, there were some adjustments that were done in the amount of money that Minneapolis and the state of Minnesota would be putting in, moving that number from $51 million per year down to $37 million. And that's consistent with what the Senate has done, that is consistent with what the House has done, and it's recently consistent with what the governor has suggested is an appropriate number as well. And so, Madam Chair, with that, those are the highlights that I can share. We have been joined by the Acting Executive Director of the Commission on Pensions and Retirement, Rachel Thurlow, and she may have some additional things that she'd like to share if it's the wishes of the Chair and the Committee.
I think, Ms. Thurlow, at this point what we're going to do is we're going to go through the amendments. We have a couple of technical amendments here. The first one, Representative Driscoll, I'm going to go to is the 7A amendment. I'm going to move the 7A amendment. And Representative Driscoll, if you can describe your amendment here.
The 7A amendment deals with a constituent issue as we were going through and working on putting together those gaps that I was talking about where they might not have been tracked correctly by their local unit of government and the like. And it has to do with an employment status change of an individual, and we just simply need to do some technical correction to bring that into line with that individual's involvement or tenure with their local unit of government for the payback that they would be required to do.
And Representative Driscoll, this then matches the Senate language, correct, by doing
that? Madam Chair, yes, that is exactly right. It does match the Senate language that was adopted in their Finance Committee about a week ago.
Members, questions to the 7A amendment?
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the 7A amendment, it looks like it's just correcting dates that looks like a birth date and an employment date, so it must have been wrong at one point, and this is just correcting it to match what it should be.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, that's correct. There was some things that we needed to do in order to make that meet that constituent's needs that was brought to us by the respective senator and member from the House.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to the 7A amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the 7A amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The 7A amendment is adopted. Representative Driscoll, I'm going to move the 6A amendment, and if you wish to speak to that amendment as well, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm going to get started on this, and then I'm going to defer the rest of the discussion to Acting Director Thurlow to walk through this. As you've been working to codify language between the major pensions, St. Paul Teachers, PERA, TRA, and MSRS, to get that consistent language, there was we noticed after the bill had come out of the pension commissions and has been making its way through the House and the various committees, that there was some cleanup language that needed to be done. I'm going to turn it over, Madam Chair, if it's your wishes, to have Acting Director Thurlow go through and explain that for us.
Ms. Thurlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rachel Thurlow, and I'm the Acting Director of the Pension Commission. And this is purely technical. As you can see, for example, on page 36, line 6, it says, as of the current June 30th, that's what the language says now. There was some confusion and ambiguity about what the current June 30th meant, so we wanted to specify it by saying by removing current and put in of the calendar year immediately before the adjustment. So it would read as of the June 30th of the calendar year immediately before the adjustment. Purely technical, just to make sure that no retirees are confused about when they would be eligible for a COLA.
Okay. Members, questions to the 6A amendment? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so we're adding a pretty huge section here. So that's all this technical language does, line 110 of the amendment and beyond. I mean, was that, is that what you're saying that this does? Because it looks like we've got part of that in here already, so maybe I'm just...
Ms. Thurlow?
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, yes, PRA was originally not part of this. They had, as of the current June 30th, in there, in legislation as of right now, and so they weren't, it wasn't changing for them, and then we kind of went back and wanted to make it as consistent as possible, so we were changing it for them as well. Again, purely technical.
Madam Chair?
Representative Nelson.
So, Madam Chair, so are we replacing in the bill the section that starts Section 6 there? Because this is also Section 6 starting on 38.10. Is that what we're replacing that?
Representative Driscoll, did you want to speak to that? Or Ms. Thurl?
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, that'll just be inserted and then it will be renumbered.
Okay, that's just...
Representative Nelson?
Representative Johnson? It's a little confusing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will this then match up with the Senate bill once you do this?
Representative
Chair, Representative Johnson has read my mind. I was going to say the chair referenced earlier on the previous amendment. This brings it into conformity with the Senate language. This amendment does the same thing, brings it into conformity with what the Senate has done.
Members, any other questions to the 6A amendment? Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to the 6A amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the 6A amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The 6A amendment is adopted. Representative Driscoll, I am going to move the 5A amendment, and I am also going to do a... I am going to do an amendment to the 5A amendment. And Ms. Thurlow, I think where there's a little confusion on what's the adjustment is going to be, it was my understanding that we were going to strike lines 1.4 of the 5A amendment and lines 1.5.
Madam Chair, that is correct. And then for 1.3, it would just be strike and insert, colon. So, yes.
So, members, just to repeat this, on the 5A amendment, starting on line 1.3, strike the words and insert, and then lines 1.4 and 1.5, delete. So the amendment now will just read, page 198, delete lines 30 to 34. Page 199, line 2, delete $21 million and insert $31 million. Page 203, line 9, delete $16 million and insert $6 million. With the oral amendment, all those in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Madam Chair, do we have questions about that before we vote on it? Or?
Do you want questions on that, or do you want questions on the final amendment as amended?
The final amendment is amended, yes.
Okay, great. So now, as amended, the 5A amendment, if Representative Driscoll, you want to work, talk through what this does.
Madam Chair, the 5A amendment basically will take on, as you see in lines 1.6 of the amendment and 1.7, it brings it consistent with what was passed by the House in the government, state government finance bill, as far as splits between the state of Minnesota and the employer groups at all from the city of Minneapolis. So it clearly just brings, that's all it does, is just brings it into consistency and conformity with what we've done as a chamber.
Okay, and members, questions to this amendment? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Driscoll. So we're bringing it in line with what was done in the state government finance omnibus bill, but this is a change from what came out of the pension commission. This does not match up with what the Senate is doing in their state government finance bill.
Representative Driscoll.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, that is correct.
Representative Nelson.
So, Madam Chair, I have some concern about that, because in the past we have not, other than technical amendments that got the other two previous ones, to bring it in line with what the Senate's bill going forward, pension bill going forward is. We normally don't make changes, major changes like this, to the pension bill and have it in the past. And I guess I'm concerned about that, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, what does this do to the percentage of contribution to the to MERP in terms of state versus employers and
sure Ms. Roberts, you want to speak to the differences on the finance side, or Ms. Thurlow? He was asking the question of how does this change from what the state contribution has been in the past to what the state contribution will be going forward.
Madam Chair, I'd
just
like
a
to
moment,
ask,
Representative,
are we supposed to have a delete everything amendment of 1398 in our position?
Representative Earhart, if you see in your folder, you're going to have the House File 1508. That's the this is the language that we're working off of.
Well,
do you have that in your folder?
I have that, but okay. Should I go to page 198 to find this or what?
Correct. You will go to 199 in your House File 1508.
All right. Thank you.
Ms. Roberts.
Madam Chair, members, currently the state contribution to MRF and PARA that's tracked in the forecast is $24 million per year. But as Representative O'Driscoll noted, there has been further information that the state amount is too high. The total amount of funding they're getting is not needed. So this amendment will reduce the state funding from $24 million a year to $6 million a year.
Representative Johnson.
No, my question is, what historically has been the percentage contribution? I was thinking that the state was around 42%, and employers 58%. It sounds like this changes it dramatically. Do I understand that correctly?
Well, okay. Representative Johnson, previously the state was contributing, I believe it was $24 million that the state was contributing, and Minneapolis and the employers were contributing 27 plus an additional $4 million, so they were at $31 million. So, yeah, that's what the ratio was before.
So I'm probably correct on that number then.
Say that again?
I'm probably correct on that number.
Yes, it has changed in the formula of who pays the share, but this is employees of Minneapolis. So Minneapolis is paying for their share of the employees. Representative O'Driscoll, I'm not sure if you wanted to comment to that at all.
If Representative Johnson had a follow-up, I can do that or
sure.
Whenever you want me to.
Representative Johnson, any follow-up?
If you have, I don't have a follow-up for you, but if you have a follow-up for me.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, one of the things that we did in deleting the lines 1.4 and 1.5 in this amendment, the way that the law was currently written in the state of Minnesota, in statute, when the management shifted from from MRF to PERA, was that PERA could charge the city of Minneapolis an additional $3.9 million per year over and above the split and supplemental payment to PERA, which is in the amount of $3.9 million. At one point, we were talking about that number could maybe go down from $3.9 to $300,000, and then this evening there was some discussion that that maybe doesn't need to even be that number anymore. So a hard dollar savings to the city of Minneapolis right now will be $3.9 million, the way that this amendment has been written. And then the city of Minneapolis would continue to pay $31 million under the amendment, and the state of Minnesota would be paying $6 million, the total of the 37, which is the new number that our actuaries are telling us is needed to be able to keep that portion of MRF as a result of the merger in checks and balances.
Representative Johnson?
I would like a roll call on this, Madam Chair.
Sure. And Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll. I remember back when we did the MRF merger into PARA, that there was, it was supposedly be a balanced of the employer paid part of the extra money that needed to be in there. The state paid part of the money because of we're the ones that set what they get in the first place. And the retirees took a hit because they had their COLAs reduced till the funds get to a certain point. And what it looks like here is that because of the merger going together, and going forward, that the employees are still, or the retired employees are still going to get, are still going to get hit because their COLAs aren't going to go up for even, it looks like even farther into the future. The city of Minneapolis isn't getting any benefit of the. And I say the city of Minneapolis, but all the employers from MRF, and it's mostly the city of Minneapolis, but they're not going to get a benefit from it. That so they're going to still be at what they agreed upon as part of the merger, but state of Minnesota is walking out of here like bandits, that we're going to get our part reduced and get all the benefits of the stock market and all the increase in the funding of the MRF. I don't think that's a balance of what was agreed to at the beginning when that merger was agreed upon in the first place, and I guess I would like your comment on that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson. A couple of things that we need to keep in mind. The state of Minnesota has always been assumed to be the ultimate guarantor of these pension plans, and the state of Minnesota has had some connection with MRF. And if not but for the state of Minnesota coming to an agreement with helping the nearly bankrupt MRF, all of the employees that are retired in the state of Minnesota that you're talking about that were covered by MRF would be receiving no compensation at this point. So if not but for the state of Minnesota coming to that aid, the state would, those individuals would be in a much more difficult situation. Number two point I'd like to share with you, or reaction to your comments, is that the city of Minneapolis is paying no more or no less than they are right now, meaning prior to the introduction of this article into the pension bill. So they're being held harmless or held whole at the level that they're looking at. The other thing that I would bring forward in your comments, Representative Nelson, is that we were in a situation 2 years ago, a year ago, I think it was maybe a year ago, where the Duluth teachers' pension plan was in a similar situation. I don't know how close we were as far as the dollars that were necessary in order to be able to help them to stay solvent. But we put, I think, about $42 million per year in addition to some other monies that we had in. And the same thing that's happening here to MRF will happen at some point to the Duluth teachers' plan. There will be an actual evaluation. We'll get hard numbers on what the costs are going to be. And so that number could stay the same for the state's contribution. That number could be asked to go up for the state's contribution, or it could be asked to go down based on the real data that we have. It's sort of like getting it on board and then doing the evaluation once you get to the hospital to see what really needs to be done. That's simply what has happened here in the MRF situation. So we will be in a few years, no doubt, be seeing that for the Duluth teachers plan as well.
Representative Nelson, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up, I guess, is that I understand all that, but I also understand that when the MRF merger took place, that yes, we as the state are helping the city of Minneapolis, the MRF employers, as a group, to make sure this is solvent, and we're making sure that the employees that are in the MRF fund, which do not get Social Security, so the only pension they have is this MRF fund pension. I understand that, and it was something we needed to do as a state, but there was an agreement made that, you know, because the state of Minnesota sets the contribution levels, they're the ones that closed the MRF fund in the first place, so we're the ones that created the situation that was going on there, so therefore we are partially responsible for it. So I mean, it's just like I said. So we're right now, we're getting the city of Minneapolis the $3.9 million relief there. But on the other hand, we're not lowering their contribution. We're lowering ours, and so the employees going forward, the retirees are still not going to get their COLAs. They're going to, with no Social Security, they're going to continue to fall behind, which is a violation of one of our pension principles. And like I said, the state of Minnesota, we're lowering ours and not doing the mutual thing, which I understand was what was agreed upon in the pension commission, that it would be equal share, that the city would save and that we would save, and yet we're changing that here. So I think it's we're kind of reneging on an agreement that we had that the state of Minnesota made with these MRF pensioners, with the MRF employers in the past, and that's, I guess, that's more of a comment than a question.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, one of the things that I'll kind of help to shape this conversation a little bit is the reduction from $51 million gross to $37 million gross on this keeps the individuals who are in MRF on the same vesting schedule that they would be looking at, if you will, to be able to get those COLAs that were originally agreed to. If we were to stay at the $51 million on here, there could be some potential where those individuals could be overly enriched compared to other participants in PERA right now with their employer contributions who didn't need the aid and assistance of the state of Minnesota to be the guarantor of their fund. And so all we're simply doing is trying to keep all public employees in the scope of what we had agreed to doing that. And if it takes more money, the state would have to put more money in, or MRF, just using this as the example. Or if there are savings that could be recognized, those should come back to the ultimate guarantor as well. Second thing that I will comment on is, you said it was the state of Minnesota that closed MRF. Had the state of Minnesota not closed MRF and had not brought that plan into PERA, those individuals that you reference who don't draw Social Security would have nothing in the way of a pension or a benefit.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Nelson, I certainly appreciate, you know, where the formation of the argument, but I think that what we're doing is we're mixing a bit in terms of the calculation for benefits with that which is the actuarial assumption. If you take a look at the way that a defined benefit plan is calculated, and I'm probably not telling you anything new, but an actuarial assumption makes assessment based upon the sufficiency of a plan, based upon the contributions, based upon the outflow, the distributions, as well as the assumed rate of return, based upon a sufficiency. It doesn't necessarily need to be at 100% to be sufficient. So to suggest, and kindly, I hope you'll take my comments, to suggest that the pensioners that are currently receiving a distribution or a payment are somehow to be injured or to be suspect to not receiving those is definitely not correct. The state of Minnesota, the municipality that made that promise, made that contract with those people, that will be fulfilled. What we're simply saying is that based upon an actual assumption, based upon real rates of return that should be assumed in a pension plan, and based upon the responsibilities of the various entities to this program, we are making an actuarial assumption that does deliver on the promise made to those pensioners. So, you know, if it's an assurance you're looking for or whatever have you, from my experience, 25 years in the business, you can be rest assured that the calculation is there to supply those folks with what they have been promised.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the Remedial Pensions 101, but having served on the Pension Commission for a long time, I understand that, and in some ways I feel like I'm being talked down to about this, but I want to respond to a comment that when I talked about the state of Minnesota closing MRF to new employees, that wasn't when the merger took place. I'm talking back 20 years ago when they closed MRF physically and took all the new employees and put them in para. That's when we created the problem that MRF was going to eventually have with no new employees going in and the payments coming in not matching and creating the problem that we created the problem by closing MRF to any new employees a long time ago. I'm not talking about closing them when we merged them into para, and we didn't close them. What we just did is we merged the management into para until they came up to the 80%, which thank God the stock market's doing well and the stock market's helped it and made that happen faster than any of us assumed when we did the merger. But along with that, my understanding is this deletion of the $3.9 million into para, well, it's a benefit to the city of Minneapolis. I don't know if anyone that's been following this going forward knew that was going to be done here tonight either. I think that's something new that I hadn't heard about, and I've been following this pretty closely. So, Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, can you explain that, where that comes from?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, maybe at this time it might be helpful to have Ms. Shannon Jones from PERA come and talk about some of those kinds of things or to maybe help bridge some of the gaps.
Sure. Ms. Jones, if you can please come forward and state your name for the record and who you represent. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Shana Jones. I'm the Policy Director at PERA.
And Ms. Jones, the question before us is the $3.9 million. We have an amendment before us that takes that burden off the city of Minneapolis. All of the employers, they no longer have to pay that amount. Can you give us a description of why we're doing that here today? Besides that matching, I believe that this will match the Senate language as well, that portion?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, I will ask Ms. Thurlow, and I just thought about this because we made the oral amendment this mm-hmm. evening, which that did not happen in the Senate, so there would be that discrepancy.
Okay.
Because of the oral amendment tonight.
Ms. Jones, we'll get to that in a bit. Ms. Jones, if you can speak to it.
Madam Chair, on page 198 in section 9, there's a description of what the employers contribute on behalf of MRF. Going forward, of course, this is all new language. Paragraph B and C talk about the contributions that are coming from the active members and the employers on behalf of the active members. Those are the same in the Senate version and the House version and should continue to come in as those individuals earn benefits. That's what those contributions are paying for. I'm going to skip D and go directly to paragraph E, where you see on page 199 that the employer is going to contribute $21 million. The amendment is making that $31 million. Simultaneously, the amendment is making the employer contributions, the state contributions on page 203. It's lowering that to 6. Those two figures add up to 37. So if we go back to the funding stream on page 198 in paragraph D of section 9, that becomes moot because we're receiving our $37 million total. Mm-hmm. That $3.9 million also was slated to end in a few years and is tied to active workers. So that's not a predictable funding source in a pension and would just be money that's unnecessary coming into the fund.
All right. I've got Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question I have, Representative O'Driscoll, given the complicated nature of these pension discussions, does this amendment, the 5A, does that reflect the Pension Commission's work? Are they supportive of this, and are they requesting this change?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, this is not the ultimate that came out of the Pension Commission. This is keeping us consistent in the pension bill in the House as it is in the state government finance bill.
Representative Johnson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. That's good to know that it's not something that's agreed upon by those who are working in that specific area. A question I have for you, Madam Chair, does the governor and Senator Bach, are they aware that you're taking this action? I just wonder what it does to the global agreement that they're working on the financial picture. It seems like it would be problematic.
Well, Representative Johnson, a couple of things. First, you have three members of the Pension Commission right here, right now. Representative Driscoll, Representative Albright, and myself all serve on the Pension Commission. This was part of our state government finance bill, and so Senator Bach and Governor Dayton are very much aware that that's part of the bill. In fact, Governor Dayton is using the MRF funds in his own different way. He has us at the $37 million. And then he takes a portion of the savings that we have from this and directs it to the avian flu. So he just does it differently. We have it as part of our state government finance budget target. He's using it for other things. So that's what we have on this, just a little different way of doing it. And I'm sure that they're probably having conversations about that as they figure out the final numbers in the bill. So, Representative Johnson.
What?
Any other comments?
Oh, no.
Okay. Representative Driscoll, did you want to comment to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other thing that I would say to supplement the comments that you made this evening would be that there's two things that we just need to be making sure that we're talking about the two different parts separately, not blending them together. The first thing that had happened was the actuarial evaluation and assumption changes moved us from $51 million per year that's necessary down to $37 million. And that number is consistent with the governor's plan. And as Chair Anderson pointed out, the MMB has a memo talking about their backing that and what they would be using that savings and how they would use that on behalf of the state of Minnesota for the avian flu crisis that we're experiencing. The second thing is that it's also the same number that the House has. It's the same number that the Senate has. What really becomes the question, as I'm hearing this evening, is when we turn over checks each year to PERA, who pays how much? That's really what this amendment does, is it says that the city of Minneapolis would continue to turn over $31 million, and the state of Minnesota would turn over $6 million. And the amendment that the oral amendment that we did took out $300,000 here, which at one point was $3.9 million in administrative costs that would be a direct savings to the state of, or excuse me, to the city of Minneapolis. So they're made whole, if you will, because they were paying $31 million, 27 plus 4, 31, and it keeps the city of Minneapolis whole on their contribution on the new 37 number.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a couple of points. You know, the discussion kind of goes to the core reason that we have a commission dealing with pensions. This is a very complex area. And that's why we've always historically relied very heavily on the recommendations and the legislation that comes out of the Pension Commission. And in my time here, we have very seldom ever tampered with that, because we feel that the Pension Commission develops the expertise that we need, and those people spend a lot of time, a lot of hours going over the various pension plans and making their recommendations. So this is not only a deviation from what they recommended, but it's a deviation from our historic process, and that I find troubling from my perspective. But I do have a question of you, Madam Chair. I know that there are some MRF representatives in the audience, and what I don't know if they're interested in commenting or not, but if they would be, are you open to a representative of MRF coming down and perhaps commenting on their take on the change? Because I do remember when the bill, the state government finance bill, was before us, they did express some concerns, and I would like to hear if they're willing to, a refreshment, if you will, of what those concerns were, because it appears we're doing the same thing here. And if that happens, I think that would be helpful from my perspective. But the other, well, let's just stop there and see. I would have another question or comment, but
Representative Carlson,
able to come down and testify?
What my goal is we're first, like I did on the other amendments, what we're first going to do is take questions from members. And then I'm going to ask the audience if there's anybody else that wishes to provide feedback on it. And then what we're going to do is we're going to vote on the amendment. So just like the other two amendments that we adopted earlier, that's kind of the route that I'm going to go.
Well,
so,
Madam Chair, that satisfies my point. Then there will be an opportunity to hear. That's what I was interested in, whether
and
it's
Representative
now or
Carlson,
later, that's fine.
To your question about, your comment, I should say, maybe about just how this works. There's a reason that the pension bill comes to the state government finance bill. We are in charge with the financial aspect of this, and that's why it comes here. And just like any other bill that comes to state government finance, we have the opportunity and responsibility, if you will, to look at it and see if there are amendments that need to be made. And that's what we're doing to this bill. I've never heard of any bill that is held sacred that just because it came from one committee that it goes to the next committee and it can't be amended. Well, that doesn't happen here. That's never been the tradition of the legislature. Just like any bill that comes from commerce and goes to civil law or vice versa or whatever it may be.
Madam Chair, I don't need to be lectured by you. I raised the question of my understanding of the history of the work of the Pension Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand fully what you're saying, but I don't need a lecture. I don't need, as Representative Nelson mentioned earlier, to be talked down to.
My apologies to you, Representative Carlson, if that's what you felt. I'm just expressing
from the
historical
perspective. Gentle with my responses to you, Madam Chair, and I would expect to have the same respect going both ways.
My apologies to you, Representative
Carlson. Madam Chair, you did answer my question that they would have an opportunity to come down and testify. That was the important thing at this point in time, and I may have some comments later. But thank you.
Okay. Members, any other questions at this point? Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify to the 5A amendment? Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dave Johnson. I represent the MMRA. I'd just like to briefly respond to a couple of things regarding the history of the deal that struck MRF and a couple concerns that we have. I know there's been a lot of transition since the MRF deal was cut in 2010, so hopefully this background will be helpful. Unlike other pension fund situations where there's been a consolidation and supplemental amortization aid has been appropriated, in this particular situation, the arrangement was reached between MRF, the employers, and the state because the state, there were three reasons. The state was actually the employer of record of MRF for a while and took over the role of the employer as part of an act of the legislature. And during the time that the legislature was involved in appropriating money, they made insufficient appropriations to cover the unfunded liability. The second is that they actually set the contribution levels for the employers and others, and for a while those were insufficient. And the third was is that they decided to close MRF and did not provide for the legacy costs of the fund. And everybody participated, and I just say, you know, this worked really well. You know, everybody participated in resolving it in a cooperative manner. The employers participated, the retirees participated by agreeing to a reduced COLA of 1% for 16 years, and then the state participated at the level previously indicated and is in the current funding mechanism because of those reasons. That mechanism, I think, was felt that that mechanism was going to need to be in place a lot longer than it was, and the good news was is because of the stock market returns and having that money and those reduced benefit payments, they were able to reach 80% funded a lot sooner. But I think there was also concern by the previous executive director of PARA about how to move forward in a way that ensured that the liability was paid for. But in terms of just the whole notion that somehow, you know, nothing would have happened and the FUD went bankrupt, there was a significant amount of analysis on the legal liability of everybody. And everybody felt that instead of trying to resolve this through litigation, like you see in Illinois and other states, that we'd all get together and figure this out. And we did, and it worked. And I think everybody deserves some credit who was involved in that. The second thing I would just note is, you know, I understand that the amount of the overall appropriation, I'm not speaking to the split, but to the overall appropriation has been reduced and everybody's relied on it. But I think it's also important to note this, that the actuarial work that was used, and at least our concerns, and I'd note we did not get to see that actuarial work and review that actuarial work or even get to read the report until the Pension Commission acted. Which is unlike, and I've been involved in about six different pension fund consolidations over the last 20 years, and the inability to vet assumptions and review assumptions and to get comfortable assumptions, this is the only time that employers and the retirees were not able to at least see them before an action was taken. But in terms of the substance of our concerns with the assumptions, one is the first one, which, you know, has to do with the discount rate. The actuary, and I'm not questioning, and we don't have concerns about the actual mathematics involved in the actuarial report, but the actuarial report itself had a notation from the actuary that said that given the age of the MRF population, the average age of a MRF member is about 78, given that age and the fact, you know, that maybe the 8% assumption was not the right one, and according to actuarial standards of practice, maybe another one was more appropriate. Now, if there was another one that was more appropriate and that number goes down, the amount required to pay the unfunded liability would go up. So that is a continuing concern of ours. The second issue had to do with the fact that all previous assumptions, were consistent with the deal that everybody had struck, which was a 16-year COLA at 1%. Now it appears, based on various actuarial work, that it could be 2032 or later. And if that's the case, that is a concern for this reason. The average MRF pension is about $24,000. They don't get Social Security, and they agreed to participate because it was the right thing to do, but they will experience over the next 16 years a significant erosion in their benefit. There is a pension commission principle that speaks to not having that level of erosion, but that's a concern. And our hope would be, been around here long enough to understand what the overall dollar amount is, but I think it would be helpful moving forward that, you know, hopefully the Pension Commission can look at those issues and there can be a process that will allow people to get more comfortable with what's happened, because I think if we would have been able to get more comfortable at the front end, we wouldn't have the level of concern and a little disappointment that we have now. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Representative Driscoll, any response at all?
Madam Chair, not at this time.
Members, any questions for Mr. Johnson? Is there anyone else that wishes to speak to the 5A amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the City of Minneapolis. I'm not going to repeat the comments of Mr. Johnson. I agree with most of them. There was a question a little earlier by Representative Johnson about the ratio between city and the employers in the state, not the City of Minneapolis. For the record, the employers include the Metropolitan Airports Commission, the City of Minneapolis, the Park Board, the School District, and Hennepin County. The ratio when we put the bill together back in 2010 was 53-47, 53% employers, 47% state. Under the House language, it's 84-16. And under the commission, it was 58-42. And I agree that hopefully over the summer, the commission can look at this issue so we can get more comfortable with the numbers in going forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Driscoll, any comment?
Madam Chair, I'll let it stand for questions by the committee. I explain the amendment and what its purpose is and how it works.
Members, any questions for Mr. Ranieri? Members to the amendment. Nelson. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I have a question for the para representative, if she could come back. No.
Ms. Jones, can you come
Ms.
to the
Jones,
table,
yes.
please?
Ms. Jones, Madam Chair, the $37 million that's going in there, is this going to be an adequate, is this going to be the final number going into PARA for the MRF consolidation? And what would happen to PARA if this $37 million does not fully fund the unfunded liability for MRF? What would happen to PARA with that? And would other employees end up having to subsidize the cost of the MRF employees coming into PARA?
Ms. Jones?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, if the $37 million is not the right number, and I want to offer the disclaimer that with actuarial work, it's more of an art than a science. They're educated guesses. You sort of had some of that discussion. But when I say it's the right number, I can't say it's the perfect number, but it's a reasonable, educated number. So if the $37 million was not reasonable and educated, and it was too high or too low, we would have subsidization on one end or the other. So our responsibility as a pension fund, and particularly our board of trustees as fiduciaries of a plan who are held to a pretty high standard, they have to make sure that we are properly vetting our assumptions. And the requirement that was in statute when MRF merged January 1st was that we calculate how much we needed on a permanent basis going forward until 2031 so that we didn't have the fluctuation that we had had before. The payments that were coming in going back to 2010 were not representative of any actuarial figures or actuarial requirements. They were negotiated numbers that were just in place. They happened to just be more than sufficient, which is part of the reason that the plan is in the shape that it's in today. So when we did our required analysis in January of what the annual requirement would be, it was $30.3 million. That was based on the assumptions in today's world, which is what the law required us to do. As fiduciaries, we knew that that was dangerous and that would put the plan at risk. We would have other members potentially in the future subsidizing the MRF retirees. So the two outstanding issues, and actually today, oddly enough, I was able to find my notes from December when Ms. Vanek was still here. And we did have two concerns at that point in time, and that was the rate of return as well as the mortality assumptions that we anticipate will change come June with our experience study. So we went back to our actuary and said 30.3 is not a number we're comfortable receiving at this moment in time. So they did more analysis and what the impact of those new assumptions that we anticipate being in place would be, and they came up with $37 million. Now there's questions about whether those assumptions are reasonable or not. This morning, our actuary had a lengthy conversation and presentation with our Board of Trustees, and the Board of Trustees actually took the position that the $37 million is based on a reasonable set of assumptions and that they support that figure. They feel like the work that was done by the actuary represents their responsibilities to all parties involved, and they are fiduciaries of the members and retirees, including the former MRF members, the state of Minnesota, and taxpayers. So looking at all of that and knowing how plan assumptions work, they voted unanimously to support the $37 million figure provided in the analysis.
Representative Nelson, too, I think Representative O'Driscoll pointed this out as well. As part of the Pension Commission, it was Representative Thiessen who offered the amendment to change it to $37 million. That was adopted by the commission. As Representative O'Driscoll pointed out as well earlier, too, Governor Dayton has recognized the $37 million. And then I believe, Representative O'Driscoll, that the Senate in their pension bill has it at the $37 million. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, it is my understanding that all three parties will be involved in negotiating the final budget for the state of Minnesota this year are in agreement on that number.
Okay. And Representative Nelson, any follow-up questions?
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I the only concern that I have, and I guess if it's a question or a comment, but what I'm hearing from different from the MRF group and other people is because of the timingness of when that actuarial report came in, and it was new numbers that and has had late in the process that came in, the ability to review that and make sure that the assumption and are right. And I understand actuarial, and there's assumptions you'd have to make, and that's a concern they have going forward, whether that is the current or correct number, and PARA may be comfortable with it, but like I said, there's a concern there. I mean, anytime you put funds together, and I know when we did, when there was talk about putting the St. Paul teachers into the TRA, I heard from a lot of retired TRA members that they were concerned that they were going to be subsidizing these people coming in. When we did other mergers in the past, that's always the complaint we have from the people that are in the current plan, that these new people coming in are going to be, we're going to end up subsidizing, it's going to hurt our COLAs, it's going to hurt our pensions going forward. And so that's a concern we have, and that's why, you know, why I'm raising it, the concern is that whether these numbers are right, I know they came late in the process, whether there was enough time for everyone to review them and be comfortable with them, it raises a concern that the current PARA members, PARA retirees, are going to be coming back at us if, for whatever reason, the market going down, and if the numbers are right, the market going down and causing their pensions to be, or their COLAs to be frozen, that they're going to look at it and say, the reason is this is because we're subsidizing these people in MRF. And that's why we as a state put extra money into them, supplemental money into them when we do these pension mergers, so that there isn't that looking at or that impression that the other people are subsidizing another group. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Nelson, I think to that point, if Ms. Thurlow could come back to the testifier table. Ms. Thurlow, I know that after the actuarial report was done for PARA, then there was a Deloitte then that, can you speak to that, please?
Oh, yes, Madam Chair. So I had the commission's actuary look over the number as well. And again, to the point of it's impossible pretty much to figure out what the perfect number is. You more have to look at what the assumptions were that were used and whether they were reasonable and relatively conservative. And our actuary raised the two issues that Mr. Johnson spoke about, which were the COLA, the 2033 COLA, because it was chosen by PARA and not an actuary, which is somewhat unusual. And then PARA's use of 8% as opposed to the recommended lower percent. But our actuaries spoke further with me about it because they dug a little deeper. And they determined that the 2033 COLA was reasonable in the sense of with the change from 8.5% to 8% in the interest assumption rate, that will raise the liabilities, which will push out the full funded date of a plan, which then also pushes out the COLA. And they said using the 8% interest rate, the new mortality tables and another factor that I'm blanking on, I'm sorry.
The assumption rate.
Right. They predicted that PERA General would be fully funded in 2035. So 2033 is a reasonable date for the COLA. So they kind of assuaged fears on that. And then with the 8%, using 8% as opposed to a lower interest rate, they said that's not, that they, it would have been maybe perhaps more prudent to see what it would have looked like. However, it's not uncommon for actuaries to recommend a lower interest rate, assuming that it won't actually be used. And you can see that, actually, I've looked through the 2014 actuarial reports, and I think one of MSRS's, it says the actuary recommends 6.9 to 7%. So it's just something that's more of a recommendation as opposed to this necessarily has to happen in order to have an accurate number. So bottom line, they concluded that the assumptions that were used were reasonable and relatively conservative, and they felt comfortable saying that $37 million based on those assumptions was appropriate.
Okay. Representative Driscoll to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was actually going to shift gears slightly and maybe ask Ms. Jones to return. And here's the question that I would pose to her. This question I asked as a part of this due diligence process as well. Is there a way that PERA can continue to track the folks who are in the MRF group once they're melded into the entire PERA? And you heard her, and she had indicated that, yes, there was. And my next question was, are you planning to continue to watch that group? And she said, yes, there was. And I don't want to put words into her mouth, but my takeaway from her comments this evening, and she can certainly speak to the issue, was that the comments that she made, we do not want to overfund or underfund any particular group in there. So my assumptions are going to be, as they continue to monitor that, if there is underfunding that is taking place, they'll be back in front of the Pension Commission advising them accordingly, just like they've done at this stage of the game. And advise accordingly. Just as I had suggested earlier, will happen with the Duluth teachers. There'll be that process and that timeline. And I suspect that if they're, as they look at the numbers and as time goes on, it's an overfunding that continues, that we'll be back to talk about making those kinds of adjustments as well. There is no perfect world in knowing exactly what the world's going to look like 16 years from now, because if they were there was, I would not be here tonight.
Okay. And Ms. Jones, I don't know if you want to comment to that or if there's anyone else that wishes to testify to the 5A amendment. Members, any questions? Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I, Madam Chair, indicated that I had a follow-up pending testimony, but mine is a process question. When this meeting was scheduled, I hoped that we would be moving with the pension bill closer to passing this into law. When I look at you know, the fact that today is Thursday, when we look at the day of adjournment and the bill will have to be re-referred to rules, then to ways and means, that's all possible to get done. Maybe my question is more of Representative Driscoll, but with the amendment that's about to probably go on, looking at the majority here, that moves us further away from the Senate. And one thing that we may not be privy to, is there any pre-conferring with the Senate? Or are we talking about a conference committee? Because then that complicates things relative to this bill making it through in a timely manner. So maybe Representative Driscoll can comment on that.
And before I have him chime in on that piece, Representative Carlson, I made a mistake on the House floor saying that it needs to go to rules. I conferred with staff, and they said that that had been waived, and so this bill will go directly to Ways and Means. We communicated that with Representative Thiessen as soon as I realized my error.
Madam Chair, so under either scenario, there was, in my view, time. You know, so I wasn't arguing about the time so much of getting it through the House.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it even quicker, depending on how quickly you get the report up and what have you. I assume you'll probably sign it tonight. But the question that I have, though, is that we are now moving. It's my understanding, they're following the commission recommendations. We now are not in two bills, and that sets us up for a conference committee, which, with the timeline that we have, is, in my view, a complicating factor. And that's why I was asking Representative O'Driscoll if he had any thoughts about the timeline.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you. It just improved with your chair's comments.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, I was going to also comment that we did get a waiver from rules that's been through government operations. Its next stop after this committee will be Ways and Means, and then from Ways and Means to the House floor. As far as process goes, that is why we're here tonight, is to continue to move that bill forward so that we can keep the time on the clock and not let grass grow under our feet to be able to move this bill through the House as the Senate has already passed it. I can also tell you that your question relating to would there be a conference committee, the language that was adopted on the oral amendment this evening, it took out the $300,000. In the Senate bill, there is $3.9 million, the original language in that they did not adopt. So we are not completely line by line with the Senate. So one of two things is going to end up happening. There will be a conference committee, or as we all know, there are other legislative processes that can take place without giving everybody how a bill becomes a law. Schoolhouse Rock tonight on that.
Representative Carlson.
Well, Madam Chair, I made my point that the clock is running, and this further complicates it. I recognize the other amendments, but I think this one is probably the more difficult one to resolve, probably House Senate, but I'll stop there.
Okay. Members, any other questions? Representative Schultz.
Oh, I'm just trying to learn how this process works, but would it have been possible to get this earlier, or did this just come from the commission, the Pension Commission?
Well, Representative Schultz, this has been in our committee's possession for probably 3 weeks now, and so there's been hope. There was hope that we would have had budget targets for the state government finance, because these two are linked together as part of that. That hasn't happened, so we've opted now to move this forward and see where we go from there. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. So, yep. It was difficult to hear it earlier because you were waiting for the budget targets. Is that right?
Okay. Representative Schultz, yeah, the hope was that we'd have the budget targets so we'd have a better idea of where we're going.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep. So, members, any other questions at all?
426.
All right. With that, all those in favor of the five? Oh, we have roll call on this. That's correct. That's right. Roll call for the 5A amendment.
Representative Anderson S.
Yes.
Representative Howell.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Albright.
Yes.
Representative Anderson M.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Detmer.
Yes.
Representative Earhart.
No.
Representative Kahn. Representative Lane.
No.
Representative Lunin.
Yes.
Representative Nash.
Yes.
Representative Nelson.
Nope.
Representative Petersburg.
Yes.
Representative Pugh.
Yes.
Representative Runbeck.
Yes.
And Representative Schultz.
No.
Having 10 ayes and 6 nays, the amendment is adopted. Members, questions to the bill?
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, and my question goes to Ms. Thurlow. You mentioned the actuarial report. And I'm just wondering if you could, you know, for my edification, briefly outline what your understanding would be of the parameters, the scope and parameters that the enrolled actuary from the second source of audit was undertaken by the accounting firm. What parameters did they take into account when they performed the actuarial audit on the plan?
Ms. Thurlow.
Chair, Representative Albright, do you mean Deloitte? What assumptions they
yes.
used? They did not, I did not ask them to redo to figure out the numbers. I asked them to look into whether or not the assumptions were reasonable and if the $37 million as a result was a reasonable number. So they spoke a lot with Paras actuary and discussed where the assumptions came from, why they were used, and if there could have been a better assumption. And they determined that all assumptions used were reasonable and relatively conservative.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Ms. Thurlow, then it would be fair to say, and just, you know, for comfort for the members around the table tonight, it would be fair to say that the actuarial took into consideration such matters as the COLA about the sufficiency of provision for the petitioners, about the rate of return, about the base assets and the growth or the risk thereof to assets. That's probably why they're in the report. They actually mentioned that a lower rate of return might be more appropriate in light of the conservative nature of the pension plan. Would that be correct?
Ms. Thurlow?
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, yes. That is the conclusion that I got from speaking with them.
Thank you.
All right. Members, if there's no more questions from you, I'm going to open it up to the audience. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to the bill as amended? Okay, members, last chance. Any questions to the bill as amended?
Madam Chair,
Representative Nelson.
I would like a roll call on the final bill.
There's been a roll call requested on the final bill. Representative Driscoll, you get the last word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only thing that I would say is I thank the committee for their time this evening and being here with us and to be able to help to move the pension bill forward. And, Madam Chair, again, my request is that it go to Ways and Means from here.
Okay, members, with that, I renew my motion that Senate File 1398, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Ms. Kelly will take the roll.
Representative Anderson S.
Aye.
Representative Howell.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Albright.
Yes.
Representative Anderson M.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Detmer.
Yes.
Representative Earhart.
No.
Representative Kahn. Representative Lane.
No.
Representative Lunin.
Yes.
Representative Nash.
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Petersburg?
Yes.
Representative Pugh?
Yes.
Representative Rumbeck?
Yes.
And Representative Schultz?
No.
I've worked with this stuff for years.
Members, with 10 ayes and 6 nays, the bill passes and goes to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Driscoll. With that, members, we are adjourned.